So that was good. Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarship. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Giving Hope, and Karen Hale will be introducing our guests. Please join me in welcoming her.
Thank you very much for being here today to talk about an important issue in our community, and also the fact that what we're going to talk about gives hope today. The Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund was established in 1988, and it provides funding for agencies across the state that work with families and individuals experiencing homelessness. The services and assistance the Pamela Atkinson Fund enables are an integral part of addressing homelessness throughout the state. The fund helps to enable emergency or temporary shelter operations, transitional housing, case management, some permanent housing, homeless outreach, day centers, and meals. And the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund is partially funded by the Utah State Legislature, but we as Utah residents have an opportunity to give directly to the fund through voluntary contributions on our individual income tax form. We have one here that is, you know, to help all of us 50 and over here today. You will see that there is a line up here. Item number 2, the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Account, and line 28 on our form this year is where you can make a contribution to the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. So today's forum officially kicks off the campaign to encourage Utahns to check the contribution box on the tax form as they file their taxes. And to talk about this today, we have some experts in the field. And we are so glad that these panelists have joined us today to talk about this issue. We have Pamela Atkinson. The name sounds familiar. Of course, the fund is her namesake. And we appreciate Pamela's efforts throughout not only the community here in Salt Lake City and the Valley here, but also throughout the state, as she advocates for those who are in tough times and do not have a home. And we appreciate all she does. We also have Ann Burkholder, who is the executive director of YWCA of Salt Lake City. And YWCA offers many great resources to women who are found, who find themselves without homes. We also have Tamara Kohler, who's the director of the State Community Services Office, and that office helps direct the Pamela Atkinson Housing Trust Fund. And we also are privileged to have Davis. I'm sorry, I forgot Vaughn's last name. And Vaughn is so gracious to be with us here today. Vaughn is a resident at the Kelly Benson Apartments, and those apartments are a joint project of the Housing Authority of the County of Salt Lake, and also Housing Opportunities, and he'll share with you a little bit about his experience. I've asked each of our panelists to maybe just take a few minutes to tell us about how they're associated with the fund and why they think this is important. So we'll start with you, Pamela.
All right. Thank you. My name is Pamela Atkinson. I'm a community advocate, which is just a generic term for the fact that I work with homeless and low-income people. I also work with the agencies that serve them. I'm also involved with the refugees that we have from so many different countries. And when I have time, I make time for it because it's important. I also work as an advisor to Governor Herbert, I was with Governor Huntsman before, but I can advise him, as he puts it, on anything I want to, which is a wonderful opportunity. And those of you who know me know I'm not hesitant to speak out. And it may be about homelessness, it may be about poverty, it may be about jobs, but it also could be about education. It also recently has been about the quality of our air and the environment. So I sit on his policy and strategy meetings and meet with him one-on-one when I think it's necessary. And he's become a great listener and he's become a great proponent of this particular fund. Originally, when the legislature created this fund, it was the State Homeless Trust Fund. And then it was one of the speakers of the House, Marty Stevens, who created a bill to make it the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. He felt it was important to put a name actually to this fund. And you will be seeing these around with my face on it as well as my name. And what we have found over the years is that when somebody donates to this fund, $2 put up against $2 donated by many, many other people in the state of Utah, it really does affect people's lives. As I go into some of our permanent supportive housing around the valley, I see a lot of my friends who were homeless, who were out in the camps. Somebody I visited just last week, 17 years I knew him out in the camps. And then he decided to come in because he felt people cared about him. When we give to this fund, it means we care. This caring is such an important component of what many of our homeless friends feel. If they feel cared about and cared for, it helps somewhat with their self-esteem. It helps them to think, as some of my friends have told me, it makes me feel as though I'm worth it. And maybe I am worthy. Maybe I don't have to think about ending it all. If that person cared enough to do or say that for me and to me, then maybe I should respond. And there are so many people I can think of over the years who are not in camps anymore, who are not in the shelter. They receive wonderful services in the Road Home and in the YWCA and other shelters. And because people care to give and because other people in service gave, that means that many of our homeless friends, they have a life. What we all did together is we gave hope. And because people felt that hope and not the hopelessness they had been feeling, they have been able to leave productive lives. We never give up on anybody. We feel everybody is worthy of feeling that hope and of being helped.
Thank you, Pamela. Anne.
I'm Anne Burkholder, the Chief Executive Officer of the YWCA in Salt Lake City. The YWCA is dedicated to eliminating racism, empowering women, and promoting peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. The part of our mission that focuses importantly on domestic violence stems from our belief that safety is fundamental to women's empowerment and self-determination and to their ability to shape their lives and to care about those they love. So we see that as absolutely essential to women's sense of themselves and their ability to navigate their lives in the world. So giving hope and strengthening women is really core to what the YWCA does in the area of family violence. Family violence is one of the most important causes of homelessness and impoverishment that we see. And that's where the YWCA's work intersects with the Road Home and Volunteers of America and Catholic Community Services and many other homeless service providers in the state of Utah. And the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund is absolutely critical to our ability to provide core services to women and children who have been forcibly displaced from their homes because of violence. And the fund provides support to the YWCA's crisis shelter, as well as to our transitional housing, which is where women can stay for up to 2 years as they are rebuilding their lives. At the YWCA on any given day, there could be about 250 women and children living there, 250 homeless women and children receiving a variety of services. So when every year this time comes around, when we gather together as providers with Pamela and with the state of Utah and with legislators to talk about the issue of homelessness, it is an important time for us, not only in terms of drawing attention to the issue, but really galvanizing support and resources from all over the state of Utah through this very easy mechanism to give to the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. So for us, we see every day how this money gives hope, brings hope to women and children, and we're very grateful for it.
Thank you, Anne. Tamara.
My name is Tamara Kohler. I'm the director of the State Community Services Office. It's a part of the Housing and Community Development Division under Department of Workforce Services. And my distinct pleasure is to have the role and responsibility in our office to oversee the allocation of the Pamela Atkins Homeless Trust Fund through the guidance of the State Homeless Coordinating Committee. And that is a wonderful opportunity to meet with and work with our partner agencies and such advocates as Pamela as we work to understand what the needs are in the community and then take this precious resource and use it to try and alleviate homelessness, to shorten the length of homelessness, to end chronic homelessness, and to be able to coordinate those services and those needs. One of the important things with the Pamela Atkins Homeless Trust Fund is its unique state funding that we can leverage with federal dollars and other resources. So when you give $2 to the Pamela Atkins Homeless Trust Fund, we can leverage those dollars and many times get a $1 to $156 leveraging. So it is a powerful tool. $2 gets us a long way in being able to provide the services that our homeless partners need. So much of the funding that we receive on a federal level is very targeted to housing that we get from HUD, and it doesn't give us those supportive service dollars that are so critical. We have found with our Housing First model in the state of Utah that we house first, but they need those supportive services. And this is a critical fund that provides that, to provide case management, to provide transportation. Sometimes it's just the medications that they need until they can get on the proper social services. This fund gives us flexible funding on a state level, and it's a critical piece to be able to answer that need and that call to house those that are in need of shelter. We were talking about what it must be like this time of year for those unsheltered individuals. The state, at about this time each year, does a census of our homeless. We do a point-in-time count, and it's done on the last Wednesday in January every year. And my office has the role and responsibility to conduct that count. And I think one of the most humbling things is to realize we still have unsheltered individuals in the state, mm-hmm. and that we have capacity in our shelter due to the efforts that have been made on a state level with our partners, but that we still have those that are unsheltered. And it's important that we count them and we understand them and we're able to coordinate services with resources to be able to end those chronic homeless who have been in our system far too long and those who are just entering into homelessness, to be able to rapidly rehouse those. We've seen an incredible increase since we've been counting in 2005 of family homelessness. We had a decrease, and as the economy changed, we've seen an increase. We've had a very targeted approach to end chronic homelessness, and we've seen a decrease over the 8 years, a 72% decrease, which is amazing in this time and in this environment. But it took this critical funding to be able to target those resources to be able to do that. But we still have a long ways to go. We have the youth homelessness that we're concerned about. We have the family homelessness. We are focused on housing and then employment. It is not a battle that we end. It's a battle that we get better at fighting, I believe. And this fund gives us those flexible dollars. And I think one of the most treasured opportunities that I have in my position is to work with these unwavering and dedicated individuals in Pamela and some of the kindest hearts and the brightest minds that we have as the directors of these organizations. And then my pleasure to share even this Spotlight with Vaughn, those that we serve. It is an incredible stewardship when you serve in government to make sure that you represent those that you serve. And I have that distinct opportunity, and I endorse this fund. It's a critical piece of what we do. We put a lot of time and attention to making sure we use it properly.
Thank you, Tamara. Vaughn.
I just want to take a few seconds and thank you three for all that you do. It's very important. I think the reason I'm here is because everything that they've said is happened to me. It's been given to me, and the housing. I live at Kelly Benson Apartments, and I came from the streets directly to Kelly Benson. And I was just talking to a friend of mine the other day, and I says, now, you know how cold it's been. I says, now imagine sleeping on a piece of cardboard next to on the ground. I says, that was me. And through the road home, I got introduced to the 4th Street Clinic. And my biggest thank you goes to 4th Street because they literally saved my life. I see all the benefits that donations make to the homeless. I'm a success story, and I try to get that out to the homeless people by saying that I know it's an old cliche by saying, if it can happen to me, it can happen to you. But that is so true. It really can. I appreciate everything that the clinic, Kelly Benson, has done for me. If it wasn't for them, I don't know where I'd be today. When I became homeless, I never thought I'd ever be homeless here in Salt Lake, ever, in Utah. I grew up here. And it's a very scary thing to be by alone because you don't know where to go. You don't know what's being offered out in the community. And for me, giving the chance to tell people, especially the homeless people, how wonderful the clinic is and how many services are offered. And so through the funding that they do such wonderful work. And I'm so glad I'm a part of it. And I still am. I still use their services. And I'll forever be grateful. Thank you.
Thank you, Vaughn, for sharing your story. Today we're also joined by Matt Minkovich, who is the executive director of The Road Home. The Road Home is a place that provides emergency shelter and housing services for men, women, and children in our community. Matt, welcome. And
thank you,
if you'd
Karen.
Like to just share a little bit about what you do with us, we'd appreciate it.
Well, I would thank all of you and for the people of Utah who have supported for years now the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. Last night, we had over 1,150 people who turned to us in their time of need, and it was far too cold to be outside. And the Homeless Trust Fund helped us to reach out and provide services to those who otherwise could have gone without shelter. We had over 200 children with us last night. That's an emergent trend that we need to address as a community. We're working toward that. We can improve on that score. We want fewer children in shelter. And by creating housing alternatives, we can achieve that goal. The Homeless Trust Fund helps us to achieve those goals related to housing. They help us to work through the cold nights and help people to gain refuge and find safety from frigid temperatures and cold and dangerous streets. They also help, the trust fund dollars also help those who might still be outside throughout the night. Incredibly, there were people out in our community staying outside last night. Yeah. Volunteers of America is reaching out, along with 4th Street Clinic, to people who need warmth, need support, need encouragement, need life safety features. They need gloves and hats and scarves and blankets and sleeping bags. And the community in its generosity provides that. And the Homeless Trust Fund helps to support the personnel who distribute that and bring that to people who surely would go without a tremendous suffering. And we have our friends at 4th Street Clinic here who could attest to the suffering, the loss of life and limb that occurs without that kind of support. And it's broader than just Salt Lake City. The Homeless Trust Fund is reaching out to every corner of the state. In frigid Logan last night, there were services that were able to be provided thanks to the support provided by you to the Homeless Trust Fund. In St. George, in Blanding, mental health services for people who are wandering the streets, desperate, hearing voices, not knowing where to turn. And little by little, dedicated people throughout our communities are working to help forge those relationships, to establish trust, to start the healing process where a person in a wash in a sea of desperation can find hope and can find the prospects of improvement, stability, and healing. And every day that's happening. 1,150 people in our shelters last night, but families moving out every single day, individuals moving out every single day. People who you might, if you were to look at them on paper, mental health, substance abuse, physical infirmities, abject poverty, no viable source of income. Boy, that's a tough bet to draw a plan for success with so many odds that seem to be conspiring against that one human being. Nevertheless, people achieve and succeed, strive and accomplish. Frankly, I would have not thought it possible. But I've witnessed it far too many times to realize that it's not just an aberration. It's not just a fluke. It comes with investment. And it is a return on our investment of compassion and goodwill and financial resources. And the Homeless Trust Fund provides those financial resources. And we harness that to the goodwill of a collective effort of remarkable human beings, not the least of whom are those who come through our doors asking for assistance. For all you brought to the table, Vaughn, that's how change began. For the hope that you brought to the table, we try to leverage that. We try to work with your remarkable gifts to find a better alternative. I can only imagine, although I've witnessed it, I can only imagine the sweat equity that you invested, the despair that you stared down and overcame, and the ongoing work that you perform, not only in working in improving your life situation, but the inspiration you provide others and the encouragement you provide others. That's quite apparent. So I have yet to see anything that's happened by one person pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. Physically impossible. I don't get the analogy. It's never worked for me, and I've never seen it. What baby nurses themselves to adulthood? Haven't seen that. But I have seen remarkable efforts on the part of a variety of incredible human beings that bring their resources to the table, that bring their goodwill to the table, and transform communities. And in the midst of the challenges that we have faced, sometimes for decades, in the midst of increases in the number of families that are coming to us, in the midst of disturbing trends that should capture our attention, we are making progress. We are going to overcome this. We've developed models, rapid rehousing that helps families spend less time in shelter, collaborations that help children to not lose the progress they're making in schooling, housing alternatives that we create that help people who otherwise would go without find housing and reweave the fabric of the community, and we become a more stable, better, more effective community as a result. And that's going on too. Challenges are big. We've got to pony up. We've got to do a lot more, a lot better. But I would like to testify to you that I firmly believe we are up for it. But not a moment to waste. We can celebrate a victory or two here. That's fine for a moment. Learn from it. Learn from a lot of failures and mistakes and keep working forward. It takes your help. It takes all of us working together. For all that you've already done, for the volunteering that you do, for what you're learning in school and how you are going to advance that forward and help to change the world, I want to thank you in advance. And I want to thank all of you who have contributed to the Homeless Trust Fund, not the least of whom is my dear, dear friend here, that the fund so aptly bears her name. Thanks.
Thank you, Matt. I know we all have questions for our panelists today, and I'll start off with a question and then open it up to all of you here in this room. Tamara, you mentioned the State Homeless Coordinating Committee had approved this 10-year plan to end chronic homelessness in Utah. And the plan is based on this housing-first model that you talked about, and it really places minimum requirements, restrictions on people to promote housing placement and really increase retention. And we've seen chronic homelessness consistently decrease over the last several years. Tell us, all of you, why this plan is working.
Well, we could probably start with Matt, because he is, and the Road Home is an example of that in action every single day, why that model works. It took a group of individuals getting together and saying, this is not acceptable that we have people who are homeless for these long periods of time, and we don't have a system by which we can house them. Actually, we looked at some models in 2004 and 2005, and as Pamela could probably better aptly share, is we honestly didn't know that that model would work in the state of Utah. We weren't sure. We didn't think that the Housing First model was actually the right model. But what we found is that it's very true, that people can't even begin to deal with the issues that come with being homeless when you're in a crisis mode all the time, when your biggest concern is where I'm going to sleep tonight and where I'm going to get food. That we came to know and believe, and truly we can witness as a state, that the Housing First model is the most effective model when it comes to ending homelessness, and especially chronic. That if we house them first and then give them a safe place that's their own, they can begin to heal. And that we didn't expect them to do anything in advance. There are no requirements to that. But that we will house them if they are desirous of housing, and that we would surround them with supportive services to address the needs that they many times could not address on their own, and we would alleviate the crisis part of their lives to be able to heal and support and stably house.
There are a number of variables of why this permanent supportive housing program works, not the least of which are our homeless friends who have been willing to come in off the street, out of the camps, and into the housing, like Bourne. That takes courage to do that. But I also firmly believe that, you know, we've been coordinating services, we've been cooperating with one another, but it was when we reached the stage of actually collaborating, which to me is the highest of those three C's. The nonprofits all collaborate, you know. The Road Home, the YWCA, the state, Christy Dawes from the 4th Street Clinic, Department of Workforce Services. We all actually work together with Catholic Community Services, St. Vincent de Paul, Volunteers of America. We don't have any egos involved in this. It's not who's going to be the first to do this, who's going to outshine. We look at what the needs are of the people that we really, really want to serve. And so it's teamwork. And the acronym TEAM, in many of our opinions, stands for Together Everybody Achieves More. And that's exactly what has happened with this program that Tamara was articulating so well. You can't just take somebody from the streets and say, okay, we've got housing. They may have physical problems. We need the 4th Street Clinic. The mental problems, we need the 4th Street Clinic. We need all of the different agencies. And that collaborative, those collaborative efforts have just grown over the years. And, you know, when I was out at Kelly Benson just before Christmas and seeing the progress that Vaughan and so many other people have made, and through my head as I looked at all the clients at Kelly Benson, knowing so many of them and thinking, oh, yes, volunteers of America, we were down by the river when we found so-and-so. And finally, after 7 years, he came in. Oh, yes, we found her down on North Temple. And look what the 4th Street Clinic did. Look what the Road Home did. Or we see somebody who was in the Y. And it's people actually working together. And that's why we say this program is a success. Do we have everybody off the street? No. Just 2 nights ago, somebody told me, no, he was not coming in. And he had a tent, and he had blankets and sleeping bag. And that's when I reminded him about how to drink, and that he could only drink half the bottle of the vodka. And then he had to get into his sleeping bags and zip up, just keep out one hand, and hat and gloves and everything. And then he could finish off the rest, because then if he got inebriated, at least he would be warm and not freeze to death. And that's what we teach some of our homeless friends out there. But don't ever think it's one person or two people or one agency. It is a whole team who literally work together. And when I was down at Sunrise Metro Christmas time, another permanent supportive housing, I stepped back and looked at all my friends there, 100 people, and I said, this is a picture of quantifiable outcomes. It was outcomes of this fund that people have given to, the Utahns, that the legislature puts money into. It was outcomes of efforts by the 4th Street Clinic, by Matt's Road Home, by the YWCA, by the state and the county and the city. We have shown that by using the money very judiciously and giving people hope, that it's made a difference in people's lives.
Thank you.
There's this interesting thing that is going on across America. You have homeless shelters. There was a time in our community in the mid-80s where we might have had the rescue missions, which have been around for some time, and they're rather small, and they're helping kind of the stranger passing through town or the fellow, maybe in the old days they called it the shell shock vet. But that it was a really small market share, if you will, if we could talk in terms of markets and market share. And overall, the market had created housing that more or less was fitting the needs of the majority of the population. Now as time unfolds, we had more families and individuals who weren't fitting into the market housing as it had been designed up to that point. So there were people coming in to the homeless sheltering system. And so the first thing that communities did across America is you need to get people inside. So you create shelters. And that's helpful. People get inside. And then immediately you're left holding, grappling with the question of, okay, what next? And over the years, it seemed that more and more people were coming into the sheltering system. And we were reaching capacity and exceeding capacity. And trying to create housing here and there, trying to help the people that, you know, just needed that little boost and they were on their way. And we weren't really getting there. The numbers continued to climb. We started seeing the same people over and over again. And so we started to study it. And the we here is the collective we, the United States of America. And researchers out of the University of Pennsylvania took a closer look at shelter consumption in downtown Philadelphia and downtown New York City. And here's what they learned. They learned that about 90% of everyone who was coming through the sheltering systems in those jurisdictions had a very brief episode of homelessness, one, maybe two, very brief in duration, and they moved on their way, never came back. There's this smaller subset, however, about 10% of all those who were experiencing homelessness over the time period that they studied, who were in a chronic, persistent, nagging state of homelessness and had turned to the sheltering system as their permanent housing destination. Now, when you look at the amount of shelter that people were consuming on any given night, that 90% were taking up maybe about half of the shelter beds on any given night. So, too, were that 10%. 10% of everyone experiencing homelessness, very small, manageable number, were living in the sheltering system, had turned to the sheltering system as their permanent housing destination. They had made a business decision, frankly, because there is no other housing. It's quite a reasonable prospect. If you have nowhere else to go, stay at the shelter until you find somewhere else to go. And when there's nowhere else to go, you stay at the shelter longer. And little by little, the sheltering system was becoming crowded and overcrowded. And with a reasonable exit strategy on a part of 90% of the folks and no prospect of housing or hope for the other 10%. Rewind back a dozen years ago, part of my job when I was at the Road Home was overseeing, making sure everyone had shelter, and it entailed 200 men lining up, getting on buses, and being transported to our Midvale facility because there was no room downtown, so we had to rent more space to help people have a place to go to get out of the cold. So we fire up buses, send 200 men nightly down to Midvale, we'd sleep in cots, be bused back to downtown Salt Lake City at O Dark 30, and be released out to the streets. Wow, that is just not, I mean, okay. Thank goodness we have that service, and boy, can't we do better than that? Well, Housing First has transformed that. Let's fast forward to today. We're serving more men than we ever have before, ever in our history. More men are coming to us. That's a problem. We're not busing a single man down to Midvale because we've created housing opportunities for that 10% group, or at least some of them, and it has a measurable impact on our capacity in the sheltering system to serve more people. So it's a more effective use of the sheltering resource. It's a more humane strategy because it creates permanent housing for people who would go without. And it's more economically viable because it provides a way out of creating more and more and bigger and larger shelters. And so when we create enough housing to reach a tipping point, we'll actually see the number of people staying in shelter on any given night going down, even though we could be serving a growing number of people who have that one-time episode of homelessness that for all sorts of reasons can happen. It's understandable. But we'll be able to get out quickly because we have more housing opportunities in the community. So we can shrink the sheltering system, which has unfortunately become inflamed across urban America as a result of a lack of forward planning and exit strategies. We're going to get there. That's not Pollyanna-ish, pie-in-the-sky thinking. It's practical strategy that pencils out economically and makes so much sense from a humanitarian standpoint.
Thank you, Matt. All right, we'll open up for questions from the audience now. Kendall, do you have some direction?
Yes, please just speak clearly into the mic and state your name and a little bit about yourself, and then go ahead and ask your question. Does anyone want to start?
I'm Chelsea. I'm a health journalist and marketer. And I'm wondering if you could help us understand some of the reasons that people go without shelter and services, even if they're available.
Well, some of my homeless friends who have opted to sleep out even in this weather, some of it is stubbornness on their part. They feel they've chosen to have this way of life and they don't need shelter. Some of it is their need to have a drink, which they can't do if they go into shelter or drugs. Some of them like the companionship that they can have together with their friends. I see you're nodding your head, one of my friends from Kelly Benson. I think it is a different reason for many people, but the commonality is that need to keep on with the lifestyle and the independence that they have craved and that they feel. The people that we follow up very closely on are those who have a mental illness and may not understand clearly that they do need to come inside. So some of us do go out in the evenings to look around for people. If anybody wants to add to
that. I think if you happen to be afflicted with even a moderate level of social anxiety, if the prospect of any one of you getting up here and turning around and speaking to this group gives you a little bit of a butterfly or more, I think it would be a very intimidating prospect to go through the process that our shelter has in place in order to get 1,100 people in. We have beds close together. We have bunk beds. It could be a very intimidating prospect. And so if you happen to have social anxiety or worse, schizophrenia, or claustrophobia, I think that, you know, that becomes an obstacle. We have some women who only come to us during the coldest and wettest of nights. And for them, there are some that even if we have a bed available upstairs, they say, I'd prefer a cot if you don't mind over here down the hall. Want a little privacy, a little sense of space. As we strive to become as efficient as possible to get everyone in, there are costs and benefits to that. You know, on the numbers side, great, boy, we made an impact. On the individual side, there are costs associated with that. That's why housing is so much better.
Great. Yeah, I think you have one of the best. George Zinn, how you doing?
Hi.
Can you hear me okay? I think you have one of the best programs in the country as far as, you know, being able to get people out and helping them and so on, and on all these programs to stop this chronic homelessness problem. Sometimes I'm a little bit concerned that we're throwing fish instead of teaching them to fish so much. And I wonder if that's just due to the fact that maybe there's just not enough programs and not enough money involved, you know, that we could maybe incentivize a lot of these particular people. A lot of people look at and say, well, what's in it for me, before they're willing to do anything, you know what I'm saying? And if there was something that we could do to get the community and all the businesses more involved in contributing to this in some way, so that we could get more money and more programs involved, so that we could keep these people off permanently off this program.
I'm trying to think about how to respond from our perspective at the YWCA. We want every woman and child who comes to the YWCA because of family violence to have a permanent home, to be safe and free at the heart of their lives. We have an upside-down world. In our upside-down world, what happens, most likely in a situation of family violence, is that a mother leaves with multiple children. She leaves her home. She has a home, but she has to leave it. And she has to go through a very complicated, sometimes very long process of weighing costs and benefits to leaving that home. So many of the women and children we see are not chronically homeless. They have episodes of homelessness. They're situationally homeless. But they had homes, but they can't live in them anymore. So I heard just this morning at a conference a prosecuting attorney talking about how he was having a conversation with a mother about leaving an abusive situation. And she said, you know, if I leave my marriage, my children will have no health insurance. And that is not going to change for them. There are complications that are going to make it very difficult for us to have health insurance, for them to stay in the neighborhood where they have grown up. There are so many barriers to that that honestly, I think for us, some of the most fundamental things that we need to do are to teach our children well, to teach them practical relationship skills, kindness, forgiveness, compassion, a deep sense of respect for themselves and others, for each of us to model what it is to have a healthy relationship with another human being, whether that's an intimate partner or a child or a friend or a coworker or someone in our church. We need to support funding efforts to be sure that if problems like this happen, if someone becomes homeless, that our communities, our businesses, our politicians, our church leaders are saying we must focus on this problem. It is not okay to have a Utah that is not the safest place in the country for families. It is not okay for us as Utahns to say that about our state. It is not okay for Utah to say that we have thousands of chronically homeless people on the streets. It is not okay for us to say that homeless people do not receive the health care that they need. It is not okay to say that we do not have enough permanent supportive housing. So the problem is large, but in some ways it is... its solution requires imagination, but it also requires will. It requires our will, our conscious choices to change and to become the families and the community and the state and the kind of world that we want to be. And that requires choices on each of our parts, and it will differ for each of us. But to have resources like the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund to help us deal with pieces of this issue where we can, I think, is essential. It's a long answer, but...
And there exists a great will to work, a collective will to work on the part of those who move out of homelessness and into housing. One of the challenges and one of the opportunities with which we work is to create employment opportunities through collaboration with the Department of Workforce Services, which helps to provide job coaches to help people learn and develop skills that are marketable, to help them find opportunities to work. And there is tremendous will to work. Now, there are some who, frankly, are of retirement age by the time they're getting into housing, and they may be able to do some work, but probably not full-time career-type employment. But there is a great deal of will to work, and I think that's an area where we can continue to improve going forward. But it is on our radar screen collectively, and we look forward to producing more outcomes in that area. One very anecdotal piece. For 13 years now, I've had the opportunity to rove Rio Grande Street, and sometimes I go out there with a broom, sometimes a snow shovel, depending on the conditions. And I mean... it holds true to this day and to just about a week or so ago. I can't keep that broom in my hand. I take two out now, just push one at a time. And they're invariably, inevitably, gentlemen come up and say, "Sir, may I take that? Do you mind?" "You bet, fella. Take it. You betcha. Both those brooms, that snow shovel will be out of my hand." Often, there's something else that comes with it. "You know, I used to be a supervisor. I was in the Navy. I think the subtitle to that is I'm worth something, I have something to give." And when we harness that, boy, that can be transformative too. And it takes, as Ann said, our imaginations to work collectively to think of different options. Valley Services creates job opportunities for people who probably don't conform to the 40-hour work week usually. And that's one good alternative. And we work with that organization. There are many more that we have yet to discover, I'm sure.
And also with Valley Services, I now work the front desk through Valley Services at Kelly Benson.
Nice.
So it does work. For me, being homeless, because most people that are homeless aren't aware of what services are offered. I'm the chairman of the CAB committee at 4th Street. I have three CAB members here also. What our purpose is we advocate for the homeless to give them the information they need about 4th Street and what services are offered, because a lot of the homeless aren't aware of what they can receive at the clinic, not just medical, but a whole range of opportunities. And like I said to Kelly Benson and my caseworker, I now have a part-time job, and it's wonderful.
That's great.
My name is Eric Clark. I am a pre-med student here at the U. I've been volunteering at the Road Home off and on for the last year and a half. And some of the things that I've wondered while I've been there is, for those 200 children that are currently at your facility, how do you keep track of their educational pursuits? And then also, what psychological programs do you guys have available?
That's a great question, and thank you for your service as well. It's very difficult for a child experiencing homelessness in let's take what we would characterize as a happy story, if you will, generally speaking. A family experiences homelessness, turns to the sheltering system, receives shelter, supportive services, housing services, helps locate an apartment, moves into that apartment, the family moves out of homelessness, we celebrate, that's fantastic. That child probably was falling behind in school. Who knows where the family was before they became homeless in our shelter. Likely they were staying with friends. And so there was move number one out of one school for the child, and the child became a new school. It became a new student in a new school in a new neighborhood, was the new kid before ever coming into the shelter, odds are. Then the family moves across town into shelter. Move number two, new kid again. Same textbooks, not sure. What were they studying? Who knows? Where was he or she getting her homework done? That was not the big priority. Then, congratulations, you're in housing. It's over here, out of this class, and the new kid again in as few as 50, 60 days. It's a lot of upheaval on the part of the children. Our collaboration with the school district has been quite helpful, and they're bringing it. The school district has a worker and works closely with our team to make sure that, in this case, in the downtown shelter, he knows every child staying in the shelter, where they were going to school prior to coming in shelter, where they're going to school that morning, and are they on the bus. So he's making sure those kids are on the bus, which, incidentally, comes to our shelter first to pick kids up and drops the kids off at our shelter last in an effort to try to prevent any stigma. And there are resources at school. Washington Elementary is doing a phenomenal job. They're used to this. And so they gear up after school tutoring and that kind of programming. We're not the education specialists. We couldn't bring what they bring to the table. We open up our doors, bring our goodwill, and attach it to theirs, and they bring the expertise to make things happen. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But it is helpful, and it has improved. The trajectory has improved remarkably over the past decade. Then following that student out into housing and notifying the next school, here comes this child, be ready. And so there are district workers that are collaborating on that effort. It's very helpful. The psychological piece, we're partnering with Primary Children's Medical Center that have trained specialists, and that, I feel, is a... It's a budding, it's embryonic, frankly, but there's a reason that my perception would be such. They can be working very intensely with one of our kids, and I can very well be unaware of it. But we think that that's a budding partnership that has a lot of area to flourish. We also have a parent educator on site to help families navigate the stressors of being in the sheltering system and how to keep it cool and learn some parenting tricks while they're in shelter, which is a very stressful situation for any family.
Thank you, Matt. And really quickly, could you describe how you address education for the children who are sheltered at YWCA?
Yes. We would have about 175 children at our place every day. So our elementary school is Binion. And we have, for many years, had a specialized children's advocacy and intervention program that is after school, is peer support groups. We are right next door to the Children's Center, which is the only nonprofit in the state, I think, that provides mental health services for very young children. So we also work with primary. So as many needs as we can meet while the children are there, which could be 2.5 years. So our hope is to be able to surround them with love and normality to the extent that we can provide it. And as many services, both within the YWCA and with partners in the community, to help them see that life can be different and to support them in that as they grow up.
Thank you, ma'am. We're about out of time for this forum. Again, I thank you for being here today, and thank you to our panelists. I believe this forum was aptly named Giving Hope. When you listen to the people who are up here today, I think that certainly gives hope not only to those people who are experiencing what Vaughn has experienced, to give hope to those people to know that there are services, service providers, there's great opportunity that awaits because of the work of many, many in a community. I think it gives hope to service providers who work with the community, and it certainly gives hope to the strength of our for the strength of our community. So thank you. I'm just going to close by asking each of you to give a 5-second elevator speech on why we should be contributing to marking that box, line 28, on our individual income tax form, the Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund. We'll start with you, Matt. You have 5 seconds.
Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund saves lives and improves our community.
Thank you. Pamela.
A small amount of caring, like $2, can change somebody's life, and you may never know the difference, but believe those of us who are involved, it does change people's lives.
The Pamela Atkinson Homeless Trust Fund provides safety, hope, and opportunity for women and children throughout the state of Utah.
The Pamela Atkins Homeless Trust Fund, which we have the stewardship of allocating, is a fund we can leverage and we can bring more dollars to meet those needs. And housing changes lives. We know that in the state of Utah.
And finally, it gives hope to the hopelessness. It gives, a lot of hope.
Thank you. Well said, Vaughn. Thanks again to Matt Minkovich, Executive Director of The Road Home. Thanks to Pamela Atkinson, a community advocate. Thanks to Ann Burkholder, the Chief Executive Officer of YWCA of Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kohler, of the Director of the State Community Services Office. And thanks again to Vaughn Davis, a resident at Kelly Benson Apartments. Have a great day.